Today I'm speaking with Matt Gutman. Matt is a software engineer and analyst in Chicago, Illinois. He holds degrees in philosophy, business management, English literature, and education, and also have an active and intriguing online presence on Twitter at RealTimeAI. So Matt and I had a great conversation, and yeah, I think he might have broken my brain there for a bit when I was trying to wrap my head around what he was saying and push back, because we had some fundamental disagreements there, which I really enjoyed. Matt was a good sport about it. Also, I want to flag that I used a new recording software for this one. It's supposed to be the best, but we did have some latency issues where Matt cuts in and out a bit, but it was fairly minor, and the content was good enough for this not to be an issue. I didn't include my Patreon donation ad in the middle, so if you like what I do here and you want me to keep doing it, I would appreciate if you consider becoming a Patreon supporter. So to do that, you go to patreon.com/doexplain. And thanks to all of my current supporters. You guys are the best, and I love you. But with that said, let's jump straight in with Matt Gutman. All right, so I'm here with Matt Gutman. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, you are one of 10 people that I follow on Twitter.
I'm very honored.
Yeah, so I find you to be very interesting, and you seem to be a man of many interests.
Absolutely.
So I thought maybe we could jump straight in, and you could tell me a little bit about your intellectual background there. What who are you? What are your interests? And we can take it from there.
Hey, so I first became interested in philosophy in college. I was interested especially in ethics and how we make decisions. Like everything in philosophy, that led me to every other problem in philosophy. You know, if we want to know how to make decisions, we need to know what matters. I think that has to do with other agents, other things that are conscious, which leads to questions about what is consciousness and where does it come from? And that leads to questions about, you know, what is the nature of existence and how do all these things tie together and so on. So I have always kind of explored this in just a haphazard fashion. If I'm interested in an idea, I will look into that idea. And if I don't find something compelling, I won't. I've found some pushback in academic type circles because of that process. Some people like to be very systematic. They like to review everything in the research and take every position very seriously. I tend to be pretty haphazard. So if I find something interesting and compelling, I'll go in that direction. And if I don't, I won't give it much credence.
So if I ask you a question today and you don't like it, you'll just hang up.
Yep, I'm just going to be out of here.
Yeah.
David Deutsch, you know, when I first encountered him, I encountered him on Sam Harris's podcast. And his ideas just seemed so useful in resolving some kinds of conflicts that did seem to be compelling to me in philosophy before them. And it sort of made sense of those kinds of concepts. So especially, you know, the idea of just explanation as a central criterion resolves, as you know, the philosophy of language type questions where you are going in a circle trying to define all of your terms.
Yeah.
And in a similar way to Sam, it's not exactly a criterion, but the idea that we can make sense of morality by starting with basically, almost axiomatically, the well-being of conscious creatures. That's really, you know, although obviously in a Deutschian framework, we don't want to just have axioms, that is a place that you can kind of start ostensibly, and then you can use that to criticize any other ideas about what might constitute morality. And in a similar way, a lot of Deutsch's ideas, you can use them to criticize other apparent problems and sort of eliminate them and move on to more interesting questions.
It's funny that you mentioned Sam Harris's podcast, because I was a diehard fan. I still am of Sam Harris to some extent. And I found David on his podcast as well. And did it take you a long time to go and actually read The Beginning of Infinity? Or was that something that you jumped on immediately after hearing that?
I jumped on it pretty immediately. The first thing I did was check out, you know, a few of his other like TED Talks and listen to his podcasts. But yeah, once I read the book, I pretty much saw pretty quickly the way it could resolve different questions that I had had, and the way it kind of, it gave a new framework to think about these kinds of questions, especially in terms of abstractions, basically the reality of abstractions, taking them seriously as their own kind of entity resolves a lot of questions. I do think that some of the, obviously, and we'll talk about this, some of the conclusions that he draws in other areas are a little, they go a little too far.
Right.
But the idea of different layers of abstractions and frameworks like that being the basis for how we know about things resolves, you know, some background questions.
Yeah. I actually thought that, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this on the podcast before, but I didn't like the book at all when I read it the first time. I had this overarching feeling that because I really enjoyed what David said on Sam's podcast, I should be enjoying it. But I was kind of forcing myself through it a lot of the time. And it took me maybe about a year after that and reading it a second time to really have everything click into place for me. But I think a big difference between you and me then is, like you alluded to there, you've still retained some parts of your old philosophical framework and then found ways to integrate the central tenets of the Deutschian philosophy into this. Whereas I would say that I have maybe taken one step further in how persuaded I am and how much I've left my old frameworks behind, which is, really what I want to hash out with you today. So could you maybe sketch, because we'll dive deeper into each one, but if you could say, what are your main issues with, I mean, I guess critical rationalism in general, but especially the Deutschian critical rationalist worldview as it is today?
So one of the problems in philosophy generally is that every question points to every other question. So when you want to think again about ethics, you will end up asking about consciousness. When you ask about consciousness, you'll end up thinking about ontology. What is the nature of things?
Mm.
This leads to a kind of circularity in every conversation, and it kind of gives you the sense that they're are no foundations and that there's no way of resolving any of these questions. And that is always kind of a background anxiety when thinking about any one of these issues. Critical rationalism kind of solves this by telling you you're not trying to create a central system that solves every question. You have a particular problem, and what you need to do is resolve that problem within your best understanding of the world to date. And so I've come later on or now to think of this as a system of, you know, frameworks, and each of the frameworks might encompass other parts of other questions, or probably David would call this reach. A given explanation will have some kind of reach. But so as an abstraction or as a way of thinking about systems and about what you're trying to explain, the system of thinking of the world as a bunch of mechanical, you know, physical objects allows you to resolve maybe earlier what appeared to be a bunch of different questions about, you know, what kind of different elements are in wood that make it able to be hard and also to be fire? And then what kind of thing in the sky holds up all of these stars? These might seem like different questions, but once you have the idea that you can look at everything around you, assign numbers to it, and, you know, put it on a graph, that gives you a tool that unifies your earlier questions. And in the same way, I think the critical rationalism shows you, once you have a framework or a way of thinking, you can then see where else you can apply that. And if you need to resolve questions in different frameworks, you can see if there's something that is able to encompass both of them. And so one of the biggest problems still that I think about or questions is how to put consciousness together, obviously, with physical systems. I still don't see a central framework for that, which is another way of saying pretty much that I find David Chalmers' hard problem of consciousness still compelling. I think that maybe the unique part of my view in this is that I view this as just an epistemological problem that we can sort of see, and various attempts to resolve it, they are pointing at sort of possibilities, but really there's a central lack of ability to put these two systems together. And pending some discovery in that direction, we don't really have an answer.
Right. These two systems you're talking about are biology and our subjective experience.
Yeah, pretty much. The physical world, the way that we describe the physical world is in terms basically of an objective, maybe numerical system for pointing at objects and describing where they're going. And then there is the central experience that we have that is, you know, everything that we subjectively are ever aware of. There's no language or ability to put those together because the language that we use to describe the physical world has no way of referring to the experience. And whenever we put them together, apparently, it's through correspondence.
So is this a claim from your side that there's no way in principle to explain with language these experiences, or are you just saying that currently, with our best understanding now, we don't have that capacity?
It's more of the latter. So yeah, becoming a fallibilism fan has made me just much more comfortable saying, you know, we don't know at the moment what this is. Certainly there's some possible discovery that would bring it to us in the future. But this is another place where a bunch of these ways of thinking are kind of analogous in the epistemological problems that they run into. So as an analogy, what was my analogy?
I don't know. It was a good one.
So as an analogy between these different ways of thinking, I'm going to talk about Sam Harris's way of incorporating science into morality. There is sort of a fundamental problem here between the is-ought, right? The David Hume, Sean Carroll is-ought problem. Mm. The way to resolve this is not by, you know, finding a fundamental way of connecting these. It's by noticing that epistemologically, there just is nothing available to refer to morality besides conscious creatures and their well-being. And so we do have sort of a gap, but that gap never comes up when we are using morality as a theory to solve problems, because there's only one thing that presents itself as a plausible way of operating.
Can I just interject there real quick and ask, because I'm not sure I see what the gap is. As far as I understand it, you can't deduce the ought from the is, logically, of course, but that's not what we're after, because moral knowledge in this framework works just as any other knowledge. It's fallible. Mm-hmm. It has no foundation. Yeah. And so moral and factual explanations are intimately tied together. And I would say that's all we need, and that bridges any gap that we think we have. You take issue with that then?
Yes. So I do see the issue as in I do find it a compelling is-ought problem. And I don't think it's a problem for the way that we use these explanations. So I would agree with David and, you know, or his apparent view that we don't need to solve that problem to create moral explanations. And that within the moral explanation framework, we are referring to physical objects and where they are and so on as part of how we make those moral explanations. But we are always using them in kind of a separate sense, right? We are first asking, and this is where consciousness comes in as a relevant question. We're asking, okay, when such and such thing happens to a cow, I can see all of the events happening to the cow. And now I have separate explanations in my other frameworks about what does that imply, you know, for whether the cow is suffering or not. And if I see something happening to a person, I have explanations about what happens to people that cause experiences. And so I will have other theories relatedly about what the person is experiencing or what the cow is experiencing. But then those explanations are themselves kind of the key to then the subsequent explanation about what is good or not good in those situations. So when we have a disagreement about, you know, how should we treat people or how should we treat cows, that's going to rely on an explanation about what those experiences are that are related to those situations, and then how do those experiences, you know, connect to the moral framework of what is good or not good. And so there's that gap when you want to get to the question of how do experiences relate to the physical world. So, I mean, there's a sense in which they appear to be the same problem or question about what is out there.
Okay, so you are somehow separating morality out when it comes to the fallibilist worldview, in a sense where you do want some foundation, when it comes to experience. Is that just a matter of you thinking that you can't see any way out of how morality could possibly be devoid from conscious creatures and their suffering, to use Sam Harris's terminology there?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, because I mean, I would definitely give you that that's a great approximation and probably the best theory we have as of yet. But in terms of explaining what we should do next, would you claim that to be a fundamental claim, like something that is indisputable, or is it just a heuristic you use as of now? Because then I would see it compatible with the way I would view morality, more in that fallibilist way that I sketched out before. But I'm not sure I see the gap still.
Yeah. So the central dichotomy or dilemma that I see in consciousness, just to spell this out more specifically, is so when we look at the world, we can, you know, make descriptions of it and what's happening in it and so on. Part of that will include assumptions about things like you being conscious and me being conscious. I assume that you're conscious because you look just like me. And my other explanations about the world include that things happening in me will be happening in you, and that the same systems control both of us and so on. And these are, you know, maybe not built up from the foundation, but my ability to analogize that way relies on explanations about the world existing, right? I'm not a solipsist. I'm not a particular computer program being fed information about something that looks like you. I have to start, or at least not start, but I have to have a framework in which there is something like an external world and both of us are here. That's necessary for us to both be agents in the relevant way.
Right. But would that be because those are effectively the best explanations you have as of yet? Or is it more of a cogito ergo sum Descartes argument of starting with foundations?
No, so I don't think it needs to be a foundation, but we are in a framework when we're looking around and making those kinds of explanations.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's really two just options when looking at consciousness. You're going to need some kind of way that consciousness arises in the world from a previous condition of non-consciousness. So this would encompass everything from different kinds of functionalism, different kinds of emergentism. You know, integrated information theory is a way of saying, here's a structure in the world. That structure causes consciousness or is associated itself with the only consciousness. If you want to say that it's just a certain kind of algorithm or a certain kind of program, which is pretty much where the Deutschians tend to go, you're now talking about a certain kind of structure, a certain kind of process in the physical world causing consciousness to emerge or to exist in the same way that other abstractions do. So if we have a chess playing program, right, you can ask at an abstract level, is such and such a system a chess playing program? That will just take a theory of chess that doesn't need to be based or founded on anything. It can just be its own way of, you know, describing what chess is. And now you can look at any system in the physical world and ask, does it instantiate that same abstract property? When you want to do that with consciousness, you're going to have to make that final leap between experience and the structure. But unlike chess, you haven't defined consciousness in a way that is itself part of the same system. Consciousness is just sort of the brute fact that you're trying to get to that is separate from all of those descriptions. So I see the other possibility in terms of where does consciousness come from in these systems as panpsychism, which is just, you know, we're not describing a particular conscious center or locus or individual. Consciousness is just a field like physics. It permeates everywhere. And we're just describing properties that of consciousness or patterns of consciousness. So when a chess playing program exists, there is sort of the potential anywhere to have computer programs. And then this is just the pattern of computer programs that we are calling chess.
Yeah.
That would be, you know, something like a person. A person would exist in a certain kind of pattern out of previous conscious, you know, patterns everywhere. Now, I'm going to call behaviorism kind of an epistemological block here, because we're always just describing patterns and relations between them. various advances of functionalism or emergentism or, you know, kind of unified consciousness theories, they need to point to some particular property in the world. So someone like Anil Seth will just say that, you know, the easy problem is, I think he actually kind of misunderstands David Chalmers' easy hard problem distinction. The easy problem is pointing out all of these correspondences. But people like Tononi or Anil Seth will say that is the whole problem. You know, we only need to point out the correspondences.
So you're talking about the correlations, like the neural correlate.
Yes. So whatever the pattern is or whatever the function is in the brain or in any similar brain system, when that function happens or that pattern happens or that process happens, then you get that conscious experience, you're done, right? That's all we need to know.
Yeah.
The problem is that the only way you know, again, that that experience is of red, if you're looking at, you know, what happens in the brain when someone sees red, you're always still using the assumption or the analogy that your experience of that red is like the other person's, or that your experience of giving that kind of report is like the other person's. So when a colorblind scientist, you know, talks about red and discovers that other people talk about this certain wavelength and that that person does not have any, you know, separate experience of what it's like to see that color, they're still sort of just relying on a behaviorist description of other people, assumptions about those people being separate agents, again, assumptions that they're not in some kind of solipsistic demon controlled fantasy, whatever it is. All of those build up. But the one in which the correspondence, the final correspondence between the experience and the system, that is always just asserted. And so to make it like more topic to make it more relevant to the Deutschian typical discussion here now, I'll agree that something like a person is a creative entity, right? The kind of being that creates explanations about anything and start growing knowledge.
Yeah.
There's going to be other little quibbles here about, you know, knowledge. Knowledge and explanations must have come out of the natural world before there were agents through, you know, different evolutionary processes and pending some real explanation of what the difference is between that kind of knowledge and explanatory knowledge. It's kind of the same assertion that you sort of see it and you know it when you see it and you're pointing at it, but it's not explained within another system. But so if you're going to say that a person who is generating explanatory knowledge and doing it creatively, that makes them conscious or that gives them certain kinds of experience, that final gap between creativity and consciousness is not explained. You might, even if you formalize that system, whatever it is, right, you figure out the particular person algorithm. We can now code agents. We can now create artificial people. When you have that difference and you can point to it, you're not in a new place. You're still in the same place of needing to figure out why would that be conscious and not any other thing? And you can't say, well, it's because I experience things and I am that thing. You can't say it's because, you know, Bob over here, he reports that he experiences things when we turn that switch on. Right. If we put a person into a giant, you know, fMRI of the future that's reading all of their brain states and what they're reporting back to us, we're going to find out that some inputs and some processes result in outputs that we can detect or read or that cause them to say things to us. But when we look at which of those is happening, we're always going to be able to just describe that channel.
Yeah.
But nothing about the channel describes why the experience should be there or not. We can always just find the correspondence, but the final step of why is that pattern, that experience, is never answered.
No, and that's for people who don't know, I think that's a very good description of the hard problem, the essence of the hard problem. How will we ever get past that cleft that you're painting for us here? But I'm thinking that, as far as I know, we don't have any convincing theory of consciousness yet to solve this particular problem that you're painting here. We have some candidates, but I think, for instance, the integrated information theory that you mentioned there, I feel like that just pushes the problem back a little bit, but we still don't know why an integrated system that processes a certain amount of information just magically turns into consciousness. There's still the explanatory gap there. And the Deutschian view here, I think that it would be very quick to say that, yeah, we don't know what consciousness is. We don't have a good explanation of this gap. Mm-hmm. But the most plausible option available is that it seems like it is intimately tied with this creative program that we are in this worldview. But how that works, I mean, of course, that's still on the table. I don't know if you have that much of a disagreement with that view from what I heard you say there, because you still were, it seemed like you were still open to the idea that in principle we could bridge that gap, but conceptually we don't have any mode of explanation that can effectively do that yet. Or do you think that it's actually unbridgeable in principle? Or
well, that's one of those things where I don't know what kind of future physics. Maybe we discover some kind of operation that happens when this kind of abstraction is created in our brains, right? This kind of computation. Maybe there are some physical effects somewhere, right? In some unknown process that pretty much make it look like consciousness must be affecting something, right? Agents do change something. But part of this, part of the motivation here, or the lack of motivation for seeing the consciousness as relevant almost to the physical story, is the fact that everything appears to be physically deterministic, regardless of agent type systems, or apparently conscious or not systems. This is kind of related to the free will question.
Yes.
But it would have been a much different story if we had discovered that when brains are operating, new physical results are coming from the center of the brain, right? The brain appears to be modifying physical reality in a way that violates the rest of physics in the way it operates outside of brains, right? Then that would give us maybe not an explanation about what brains are doing or what consciousness is doing, but it would imply that consciousness is doing something, right? Physics is now changed because of a brain being there. But in the event, physics does not appear to care whether there is a brain or not. It is at the level of fundamental physics, the same kinds of events are happening.
But I don't know, why do you have to, and I just want to flag, we can go back to that later, the morality bit, because I feel like what you went into here, you're still putting you're putting consciousness in the center to begin with when it comes to morality. And I think that you could have an epistemological discussion of morality without invoking consciousness to begin with. So I think that could be interesting to go into later. But this whole part of determinism, I had Sam Kuiper's Crit Rat on for the last episode, and we actually discussed this a little bit. And I think here is where we might diverge the most. You seem to be implying there that to say that consciousness has any role to play in the deterministic framework, it has to somehow be outside of the laws of physics, something else than a physical phenomena and affecting us that way? Or is that right?
Kind of. So the typical Deutsch example here would be the statue of Winston Churchill and the copper on his nose and how it gets there, right?
Yes.
So the point of the example is that some explanations are best given not in terms of specific atoms and specific physical laws and their course, but in terms of abstractions at the higher level. And it's implied then that when I, as an agent, right, when I choose a hamburger over a chicken sandwich because I really want a hamburger and I don't want a chicken sandwich, that is the best explanation. The best explanation is not a complete story of all the atoms in my brain and all the inputs, you know, to my bodily systems before that point.
Yeah.
And so we need to take seriously my mind as the explanatory factor there. So I'm not challenging that as a valid explanation or as a good explanation, but I don't think it's better. And so one of the themes here is, one of my themes at least, is the inability to choose between some of these dichotomies. So I'm not advancing panpsychism as better than functionalism or emergentism. I don't think that there's an appreciable way to tell between them. And in the same way, the story about me choosing a hamburger because I'm hungry or the story about the statue of Winston Churchill being at the square because of the war and because of his contributions.
Mm-hmm.
That is just as good as the physical story, but it's no better. And it doesn't describe things at a more fundamental level or at a more meaningful level or in any sort of better way, other than the fact that we are the kinds of information processing systems that respond better to that kind of explanation.
Better for what? Because as I see it, you can't avoid this from the problem situation and a particular problem. If knowledge is epistemology, as far as I can see it, is it's universal. Critical rationalism purports to be a universal theory of how knowledge grows for any system creating knowledge. And the whole idea of universality of computation and explanatory universality is that there's no other mode of processing information when it comes to the computational theory there. And we, in effect, can create any explanation that is possible to create. And So I would say that some problems are, let's say, the problem of evolution, explaining how organisms and genes have replicated and created life. That might be, in principle, only possible to explain at a high level of emergence, like the theory of evolution. I'm not sure why the particles and the loss of motion, which I would say the loss of motion is an abstraction as well. Even causality is an abstraction and not inherent in the loss of motion. Mm-hmm. So I don't see how having, let's say, the Laplace's demon who has access to full information causally and the initial states and everything, why would that give you anything more than exactly that? Full access to full prediction, which is always bottom up. But we're not talking about prediction. We're talking about explanation. So I don't understand why being able to say that, yeah, these atoms will move in this way, will in any way be able to explain why you chose the burger instead of the chicken sandwich.
Yeah. So I think that kind of, like you said, it depends on the problem. And so the problem depends on the agent. And this is part of, you know, the circularity here that we go, everything depends on everything else. But when you're asking, why is that statue of Churchill in that square? Anyone asking that question must be the kind of agent who's looking for these kinds of explanations.
Yes.
So the fact that you're able to work with concepts like war and concepts like leadership implies that you have a certain problem. And so the information structure and the explanation structure is about you, the agent. And similarly, when you ask, you know, how long is the tea going to take to make? That is a question, in a sense, about all the atoms and all of the, you know, gas inputs to the house and the structure of the kettle and so on.
How is it
about those?
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be false to say, because I think when you say that it's dependent on the agent, I think that's where the universal agent is important in this context. I would agree that it's not wrong to give the explanation of at the atomic level or at the deterministic level there, but that it's equally good, then I think we're stepping away from the role of knowledge and the centrality of knowledge in the structure of the multiverse in general. Do you see what I mean there?
Yes, I think so. I'm going to be saying basically that the centrality of knowledge, I don't want to call it an illusion. It is obviously very important for, you know, what we're doing, and it has giant effects compared to other kinds of descriptions that we might make about different systems. But calling it central in something like a fundamental way, or implying that it's central, or implying that it's more important, there's a little leap there that leads to other implications that I think are false. And so when we say that, it's kind of implied that it's a better explanation because it's simpler or more useful for us in solving those problems. And then that is used to sneak in a little bit the idea that agenthood must be, you know, more or different somehow. So when I, you know, if we stick with the tea kettle example,
yes,
the story about me wanting tea and that being a useful explanation or a perfectly, and it is a perfectly good explanation, it doesn't give, it should not at least be taken to give me as an agent anything, any properties beyond the same properties that could in principle be described by a full description of what's happening in physical terms. It does not add something new. It just takes the same kind of description and condenses it, right? It simplifies it or compresses it, if you will, into a simpler system that we can use to now make even more powerful predictions with even less memory. But in principle, a giant sun-sized Dyson sphere looking at my living room and figuring out what I'm doing might be able to give you all of the same explanations about your questions using just the physical story. And it might be able to explain why all of those abstractions are the way they are in terms of how physical properties work. It's just that we don't need them, and we can just make as good use and as quick use, and in fact, you know, much better use because we're not Dyson sphere-sized entities. We can use these abstractions to do all the things that we want, and they seem much more powerful in many more different areas because of our ability to work with them. But they don't actually do any more than the physical story. And so that lack of doing any more or making any difference means that there's no reason at a fundamental level to prefer them in terms of their ability to explain other things that are not related to them. And so when we bring this back to questions about like what, you know, free will or agenthood, an agent is a certain kind of outcome in the same way that a glider is a certain kind of outcome in Conway's Game of Life. If you knew enough about Conway's Game of Life to predict all of the different outcomes, you would understand gliders and where they come from and when they might emerge and when they might not. Their property as a self-propagating little system, that doesn't mean that they choose where to self-propagate on the basis of their individuality or on the basis of the fact that they can be described using this higher level abstraction.
To me, it seems like there's an even bigger gap there of saying then the laws of physics are not an agent. The laws of physics are just a way that we can describe the limitations of the physical world. And it is an abstraction in and of itself. And I think that it sounds to me, at least, and please stop me if I'm misrepresenting you here, but it seems like you're viewing the, like what happens at the atomic level, at the physical level, is somehow first or primary, and then things follow on top of that?
Yeah, I don't want to imply that.
Okay.
And when you say physics is a limitation of reality, it's not. Physics is
the laws of physics, which we use when we do prediction in the sense that you mentioned there. And I just want to say that I want to hear how I misrepresented you there. But the way I view it is that in reality is unified. Right. And exactly. So each level of explanation is just, we're trying to talk about the same world at different levels of abstraction here. And so
I was probably misspeaking when I said that if you knew all the laws of physics and everything, you would be able to predict what an agent might do.
I think that might be correct, but I don't think that prediction and explanation can be used synonymously here or even be considered as valuable in this context. And I would say that the causality being, I think the deterministic framework is also shaped by abstractions. And I think that causality, and which is why I think that the explanation is better of, yeah, Matt, he likes coffee better. Or let's say he likes tea better because coffee makes him jittery at night and he wants to sleep good. I think abstractions, when I'm talking to you right now, what is influencing what's going to happen next, I would argue, is the particular information that I'm conveying through the physical medium, through the sound waves and whatever's hitting your eardrum and being processed in your brain. Yeah. That is determining what the physical system is going to do. So determinism, I don't see how it's only a matter of speaking about, yeah, the atoms are just moving about. Yeah, but then how do you, you're just pushing the explanation further. What is choosing then whether you're going to move left or right? And I don't see why, yeah, the atoms is a better explanation or not a worse explanation when we don't talk about prediction than the abstractions.
So this, this reminds me a little bit, of Feynman talking about when you ask why, you know, when you're asking why, it depends on what you're already allowed to know. When we ask, you know, why an agent does something and you want to give the agent level story instead of the laws of physics level story, the laws of physics level story does not include the specific, you know, things about being an agent at the level of the description of physics, because physics doesn't refer to those kinds of properties. And so you can't use physics by itself to describe to somebody, why does this person order a hamburger, or why does this person make tea? Physics does not deal in that kind of property. Mm. But the question, why does somebody make tea or want a hamburger? That question itself implies a framework that takes account of agents. Yeah. And so the person who has the problem, the person who's wondering about that kind of thing, they have that framework. If they had the same kind of framework that could admit of physics, that physics could, in principle, answer the same question.
But that's the jump I think you're making there, because mm-hmm. why is there anything saying that that's possible in principle? I would argue that there's no argument to support that. Like, what is... Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
I think to me, this is just the unification of reality. So a complete description of what happens in reality is beyond our current physics. And I guess Deutsch might say that it's just impossible in general to have a complete description of reality, right? Problems are inevitable, so you can't have a central... I'm kind of skeptical of that claim. It seems to be based itself on basically an intuition, and the intuition is basically... if you had a complete system, it would beg the question of, or not beg the question, it would raise the question of why is that the complete system, which would itself be a question that you couldn't answer in the same system. I'm not sure. It yeah. seems at least possible that we could figure out a fully deterministic way of figuring out what everything is. Obviously not in our current paradigm based on our current science of, you know, multiple worlds and so on. But we could be in a situation where there were not apparently any problems that we couldn't solve, and everything, it just looked, you know, and so it's not clear to me either way why that would have to be the case. But to stick with the different levels of explanation here in terms of physics, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that the laws of physics are better than the agent level description or than any other abstract level description. But I'm saying that when you have a question in a certain framework, there is always some other framework that could encompass that.
Why?
Why is there always some other framework that could encompass it?
Yeah, I feel like it seems more plausible that certain phenomena can only be understood at the level of that phenomena.
So I think this is the one, this would follow from the idea that problems are soluble. If you had a question that was at the intersection of any two systems, right? Yes. If you have two ways of understanding things, and they result in some kind of, you know, mutual conflict or inability to resolve them, mm-hmm. There's some way of understanding what's happening there at a level that's higher, and or at a level that is able to account for both.
Right.
And so with respect to like brains and agenthood and computation, what we know about physics, and again, this comes back to causality also and the way that everything's related, it suggests that somebody who knew enough about agents, if you had any question about people and what they're likely to do and why, if you had a complete description of all of those computations in brains, right? If you're a super alien in the future, again, with a Dyson sphere, and you know every way that human brains might be and all the kinds of things that humans might do, because you can model that complete system at that level.
But is that possible then without, because I would argue that it's not possible to understand people without our emergent conceptual frameworks as well. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like you're saying that, yeah, it is somehow fundamentally possible to understand all of these emergent phenomena strictly at the lower level if you just had full information. And I think I don't see any argument for that, why that would be the case, and why there couldn't be self-containment where some things are just, you need the abstract level. How can you even talk about what the physical level means and what certain constituents of particles merge up to become simply with those concepts? It seems like it just seems like the reductionism to me, the same assumption. Right. I don't see how you make that jump, really.
Yes. So the reductionism is a bad word in this circle. And I think it's right. Because reductionism is typically framed in a primacy kind of way, right? Like once you reduce one concept to another, you don't need the other concept. So
yes.
So the reason I don't see that as a conflict here, or the reason the reductionism is just as good in some circumstances, is that the questioner implies the existence of that framework to ask the question. So in an alien wondering about how humanity works that doesn't have a concept of leadership, for example, the full political story might not give that to them. And they might be wondering, you know, why do certain events happen? They would need to discover leadership, and leadership would not necessarily be something that follows obviously from the laws of physics. But yes. When somebody who's able to ask questions about leadership or ask questions about statues at the level of understanding a statue, the question or the problem implies the agent, which implies the existence of that framework. So reductionism is kind of a bad word because it implies once you have these formulas, you're done. And now you don't need anything else. I don't think that's true. It's not that the laws of physics have primacy in the sense that they explain everything. They don't explain everything.
But they are enough, it seems like you're implying.
I think that for questions for humans that relate to things like making tea or like why I order a hamburger, nothing about our understanding of the world implies that what is happening in me or in the kettle is happening in a way that could not be explained or not explained, but could not be predicted.
Yes.
At the level of physics. Right.
I think that's a very different claim, however, because mm-hmm. in some sense, it is disputing the reality of abstractions, I would say. And it's also disputing fallibilism ultimately, because you're postulating that it would even be possible to have a full understanding simply by having the full information of particles, initial states, and laws of motion. And I would say you're disputing the universality of the explanatory universality of us and how universal, because a superintelligence, you know those arguments, but it implies that there are other modes of computation or other modes of explanation, which implies that we are not universal in that regard. So I think this is more of a disagreement with this whole worldview than I think we might have gleaned to begin with. But I don't know if you would agree with that, but that's how I see it from what we said so far.
I don't think so. So the fact that we can keep making progress in terms of understanding different levels and new laws of physics might be kind of a red herring here because we have certain physical laws that we know about at the time. I don't mean to imply that those are, completely comprehensive or that they alone are good enough to explain everything about us or predict everything about us and so on. It's that we don't have a reason to... It's more about physics in terms of understanding reality as a whole. So if you understood, this might be more of a central, like it's not conceivable to understand everything, but a complete description of reality would include a description both of the laws of physics, whatever we have them as today, and why they are that way, and also agents and how they act and what we know about agents as they are today. And so,
and agents are emergent. So you're already postulating their existence there in more terms than simply atoms, right?
Yeah. And so that emergentism is about frameworks to me. So the same thing, physics is a certain way of describing reality. Agents are a certain way of describing reality. Neither of them is better or more fundamental than the other or preferable to the other. And so when the specific here of claims about something like free will or like an explanation about what agents do purely in terms of that kind of depends on the properties of agents with respect to physical reality. And so this is kind of back to, you know, whether agents and their behavior at some gross level is predictable from a framework that takes account of everything we know about them at the time. And so basically, given the deterministic laws that we see, it's just as good to say that somebody ordered a hamburger because they wanted one. That's a perfectly good explanation for somebody who's wondering about what that agent wants to do and already has that framework of understanding and that question. But somebody who's similarly asking, why did they order a hamburger? Depending on the kind of question, the kind of answer that they want, the physical story might be just as good. That will depend on them and their problem.
But so it seems then to be some kind of subjectivist relativism rather than accepting these epistemological theories as universal. Because the claim here from the other side is that people and their choices can only be explained at the emergent level and predicted at the lower level. And that those two things are not just because we are the kind of creatures, as maybe Sam Harris would say, or Jonathan Haidt or someone, we are the kind of creatures that like to explain things at the emergent level, but there could be other creatures that would understand everything at the lower level. I think I would claim that that would be impossible in principle because abstractions are fundamental in the physical reality as well. And I think we have slightly different intuitions there, and I think this is extremely interesting discussion. But I think I'm going to move on here a bit and just ask you on the topic of abstractions. Then, how do you see where are they, or in what sense do they exist then in your way of thinking about this? Because they're not physical,
right? So this is an interesting, again, kind of a circular apparent question once you start looking at it. So part of having theories and explanations is that you have a kind of a framework that you get built up, right? So I have to assume, we start off by assuming that there's something like a physical world that allows us to, okay, do experiments with it, and then assume that those kinds of laws that we're seeing result from the machinations of that physical world, and that I'm discovering those laws meaningfully and so on. And so when we get to something like computation and computer modeling, there's a mini circular reasoning at the bottom, you know, I think the Deutsch and the typical crit rat community would tend to say this is not a problem. You're just, you know, you're starting with whatever you need, that framework. Mm-hmm. Given that what we seem to know, that framework is itself a kind of information processing system or a kind of information, you know, managing system. So we have a framework that is based on our brain. What our brain is doing results in, you know, the kinds of things that we say and how we understand everything. And it appears to be computational. And computation appears to be the basis for all of this information processing and existence, right?
Yeah.
And so we have this kind of abstraction that we're using to understand abstraction itself. Now, in terms of what is abstraction, it seems like the typical way that I might describe it, or that someone might describe it, as properties, right? We, in philosophy, you talk about a property that supervenes onto a situation.
Yeah.
So
I love that
when
word.
We have a computer, yeah, supervenience.
Yeah.
When a computer is instantiating a chess program, chess is a kind of discrete abstraction that we have invented. And it can be instantiated or not on the basis of a system. So now that system might be a chessboard sitting somewhere, and it might be a computer modeling, you know, the situation in a chessboard. What is a property of reality, or right? Or what is a description of reality? So reality, whatever it is, physics, whatever it is the kind of thing that organizes itself in a certain way, right? It has, again, apparently deterministic ways of behaving, and those ways of behaving are consistent across different situations and time, apparently. And so, again, we're sort of relying on our assumptions about what reality is to tell us these other things about what that is in the first place.
Yeah.
But sort of our assumptions about the consistency of beliefs over time and about what we see and so on lead us to the conclusion that reality is modeled or it exists in a predictable way, in a uniform way, and that it behaves certain rules. And whatever it is that gives those rules that pattern, or whatever it is that gives reality that pattern, is basically an abstraction. So the abstraction is the way that physical reality is in a predictable and a uniform way. So now what is it? Well, that's a little bit like asking what is matter or what is reality, basically.
Yeah.
A lot of these questions come down to what is the nature of reality.
Right.
So we assume that there is physics. If you ask what is energy, you know, nobody has an answer. Energy is how we describe the apparent workings of the apparent physical world that we think we see. And when you ask what is an abstraction, well, that is just the system of description of that physical world and all of the different things in it at the various levels that we can explain them. And so I've come to think of abstractions basically as informational frameworks or models. And so when you have, and this kind of comes back around to why is the physical description just as good as the agent description? Both of those are just frameworks that I'm using to explain things. And so I have a certain way of fitting everything. And as far as I can see, these kinds of things fit everything in reality into themselves. So physics can describe anything, and agents can describe anything that you see in terms of is it an agent or not. And then physics can describe it in terms of, you know, what is it likely to do, until the points where, you know, our current physics breaks down and we don't, you know, there's situations that we don't know how to model because they fall outside of the scope of what we know.
But aren't you conceding then there that, yeah, physics, the level of explanation of physics is better for some things, whereas the emergent level might be more applicable for others, in which case I feel like we're kind of converging.
Yeah, there. I feel like the main disagreement or discontinuity that we had earlier about that discussion is at the level of the agent is in one of us. The agent with a problem is always there and central to this kind of discussion. It's kind of an epistemological discussion. It's about like what we know and what is there and how do we know that.
Yeah.
That depends on an agent. So when you talk about, you know, physics is not enough. You can't just have physics and understand reality. That's absolutely true. And I think it's probably inconceivable. I think it's inconceivable to have an agent that is creative and is a person and is creating knowledge, but does not understand agenthood or does not understand the concept of abstraction. I mean, not maybe the concept of abstraction the way we think about it, but that kind of agent is going to be doing modeling. Its problems are going to be based on its current level of understanding and its current level of knowledge.
Yes.
And so physics is never going to be, physics as we have it is never going to be the complete description of the knowledge of an agent. And so no agent is going to be asking questions that can be completely answered by physics. Nobody can ask a question about why is that statue of Churchill there without having, again, all of these higher level concepts that make sense of that in the first place. And so
And you also have to, I mean, fundamentally, I just think that if you take, and I'm by no means well-read on the multiverse or physics in general, but if you take counterfactuals into play here and what could possibly happen within the framework of the physical laws, then I think it's always going to be a limitation of the reductive level to explain why in the infinite array of possibility did the atoms choose to do this rather than that, or the neurons to fire in this sense rather than in this sense. And I think you can't get away from needing emergent explanations there and invoke abstractions. But but I mean, Matt, you just broke my brain with that whole abstraction talk there. I love it. This is a really fun conversation so far. But so I'm going to jump a little here and there just because I have a lot I want to ask you.
Sure.
So I was thinking maybe we could talk a little more about, because I know consciousness is kind of one of your central interests. And you've invoked a lot of concepts there, emergentism, panpsychism, this one is a hard one, epiphenomenalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Yeah. Which theory are you most sympathetic to as it stands? And maybe you could just give a brief outline of what they are there, and we can touch on that. Because consciousness being an epiphenomenon, I think, is kind of central to your worldview here when it comes to the morality and the free will and determinism, I think.
Yeah, so epiphenomenalism is the idea that consciousness is something that does not affect outcomes.
Mm.
So it would make consciousness a supervenient property onto physical reality. To be an epiphenomenalist is to say, when I see red at a stop sign, or when I hear the whistle of a tea kettle, the experience of seeing the red, or the experience of hearing the whistle, that doesn't do anything at the physical level. So this is related to David Chalmers. He talks about a pea zombie, a philosophical zombie. That would be a hypothetical person who's just like us. They walk around and do all the same things.
Yeah.
If we looked at them, you know, if we were observing them, we would see the same physical events. But there's nothing that it's like to be them. There's nothing that it's like on the inside. The idea of this, or the motivation for this kind of thought experiment, is to say, what then does consciousness do? And so this is central to the same kind of question we've been talking about is the physical story enough? But to be an epiphenomenalist is to say, and I personally, so I don't see any alternative to epiphenomenalism.
Mm.
And it's for the same motivation that when we look at people, the physical story seems to be enough to explain what they're doing, at least at the level of prediction, right? And so nothing about being an agent, maybe that would be a good way to put this. Somebody who had a question about why an agent did something, they would have to have that question because they had some questions about agents, right? But if they just wanted to understand what I was going to do next and predict my actions, predicting my actions would not require knowing that I'm an agent.
Yeah, but wouldn't it require to... Because what are you predicting effectively if you don't have the emergent concept of Matt Gutman as a person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't see how you can even predict an agent. You would only be able to see particles, and there would be no separation whatsoever. It would be one giant clockwork. And I don't know.
Try and formulate that kind of question then. So
yeah,
let's imagine that future people decide. I'm trying to think about a way of describing a question that would that would be interesting at a cosmic level. if you wanted to ask, you know, what would be, when's the first time that this solar system here, our solar system, is going to have something like a planet or a solar body larger than Jupiter, right, orbiting the sun, if this kind of description makes sense.
Right.
If extremely powerful future humans decide that they're just going to conglomerate all of the planets into one megastructure, right? That's a conceivable project that we might do. And if you were just the kind of alien organism or agent anywhere asking, you know, when will this solar system have a structure at such and such a mass, right? You probably would know about agents. But you don't necessarily need to care about agents at that level to ask. If you just understood the physics that would create agents over time and that would cause us as agents to have certain desires, those are all going to be physical events. It would make a lot of sense to describe that in terms of agenthood. But if you just wanted to do nothing except predict when will such and such a mass occur, the creation of that mass would be because of agents, and agents would be the only kind of people. I mean, people are agents. People would be the only kind of things that could create that in that time scale, right?
Yes.
It might be that might happen accidentally for who knows what cosmic reason, but agents could do it a lot faster and under circumstances that would never occur naturally. And the prediction of those circumstances could in principle be done with a complete, or not complete, but a good enough understanding of the physics that leads to agents and that leads them to do things like that. And you could give a description of all of those particles and what was happening, such that you could say, you know, here's how they're all going to move. And then that would predict things like some little rocket ships taking off from Earth. And we would understand them in terms of rocket ships, but you wouldn't need to call them rocket ships. They would just be part of the model. And then that model would lead to, you know, a giant engineering project, as we would describe it. But you don't need to call it an engineering project. It can be described in terms of the movement of, you know, various pieces of matter. So that prediction would not rely on agents. Now, you might ask, like, well, why would anyone have that kind of question? Or yeah. Why would anyone worry about that kind of thing? But the principle, the idea is that these abstractions, agenthood as an abstraction, is very useful for solving problems. And it is hard to imagine in the future, like, problems that would not rely on abstractions or could not be improved. And it might be impossible to imagine the kinds of people or the kinds of agents that would have this kind of question. But given sufficient knowledge about just outcomes, we could make predictions that never refer to agenthood and have no concept of agenthood, but that predict what agents will do and that rely on, like, agenthood must exist in order for that kind of Dyson sphere to be created in such and such a time, because Deutsch says that most transformations that could happen in most places would refer to knowledge, right? So most of the interesting things that could happen anywhere only happen because of this. But at a different level, you could predict all of those things given enough knowledge. And this might seem like silly or irrelevant or fantastical, because I think it is probably impossible to have anyone, it's impossible to have a person who wants to know those kinds of questions, but doesn't know about agenthood, right? You're not going to have any kind of system that is doing these, you know, universe level calculations. Nobody's going to be calculating every atom in a teapot without being the kind of system that also understands teapots and also understands people. But when we come all the way back here to free will and you know, explaining what people are going to do,
yeah,
you know, explaining it might be one thing, but predicting it, you don't need to know about agents. It might be that you always will, and it might be that there's never a situation where just looking at the physics of someone's brain would be a reasonable thing to do. But when you're just asking, you know, is someone free to do one thing or another, I'm just saying at the highest level, it makes no sense to say that they could do otherwise when everything that they will do is determined and could be predicted in principle without any reference to them as agents.
I don't think you can remove the abstractions even out of this picture, because the rocket ship, for instance, I don't think the rocket ship would exist without the emergent explanations and the knowledge of how to create
it. Not at the local level, but if you were watching it happen, you could predict without knowing about it as a rocket ship.
You could absolutely. Prediction will always be reductionist. Ultimate prediction, absolutely. But that's where, I think determinism is often explained in a way where it's missing that the way the atoms move is also going to be affected by particular abstractions. I think abstractions have a very central place in the deterministic universe. I wouldn't dispute that it is fully deterministic, but I think it's a mistake to exclude things like free will, which is also an abstraction, on the basis that ultimate prediction is possible at the lower level.
Mm-hmm. When we use language related to free will, like choosing, I like an analogy again to a chess program, right? If we have two chess programs playing each other, and just they're both on little self-contained computers, and they're just going move by move, and we can look at them, explaining what one move is or why it happens, the easiest way to do it is in terms of chess, right?
Yes.
That's an explanation. I guess it's important to keep in mind, an explanation is always with respect to a problem. And so explanations always have to do with agents. So you can't have explanations without agents. You can have knowledge without agents that could be maybe later used to create explanations for agents.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're asking, why did that chess program make that move? Well, the answer is about the knowledge in the chess program and about the situation the chess program is in. But I still don't think it makes sense to say that the chess program chose the move. You could say that and you could use that language, but it wouldn't make sense to say the chess program was free, or it made that move freely, in the sense that that was you know, what the chess program wanted to do. And it, if it had wanted to do a different move for whatever other reason, then it would have.
But isn't that a red herring of sorts? Because do you think a chess program in this regard is analogous to a creative mind?
Yes. It's analogous in the sense that we're just talking about an information processing system. And so this is kind of related to the emergentism of consciousness, right? The reason or the motivation to say that the chess program is different than the agent, right? The chess program is not like you or I.
Yeah.
Because you and I are creative. We are a different kind of algorithm, right? We are a kind of algorithm that we don't understand yet, but it's the kind that can create new knowledge and can create universal explanations and can understand them and so on. What we need is a connection between that property, whatever personhood is, whatever that algorithm is. Why would I call that property free? Why is that property different, or why is it relevant given that the chess program will do a certain thing predictably? I will do a certain thing predictably. I run a different kind of algorithm, and here's the different kind that it is. But why is that free? In what sense does that make me free as opposed to the chess program?
I would say that the difference there is that the chess program is in principle predictable, whereas I would say you as a human is not.
Okay. Yeah. This is a great place to go. This is another one of maybe my major disagreements with Deutsch. So yeah, the predictability of the growth of knowledge, right? This is a big central theme. And so this is kind of related to the Dyson sphere example, right? I think that it's misleading, or it's not true that the growth of knowledge is not predictable. The relevant difference is that the growth of knowledge is not predictable by an agent in a system in terms of its own system or in terms of itself. So you and I cannot predict our own future knowledge. And humanity, as an emergent system of its own, cannot predict its own future knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But a powerful enough organism, again, you know, just take your magical alien, a magical alien watching a man in a small room in a certain place with certain, you know, information or inputs or whatever it is, watching Newton invent calculus. if you knew a huge amount, right, and a vastly more amount than we have access to or could in principle do at the time, if you knew exactly the state of Newton's brain before he invented calculus, and you already knew all about calculus, and you already knew, you know, take your pick how much knowledge you have, that agent would be able to predict Newton's discovery of calculus at the time.
How is that knowledge anything more than knowing the particles' specific initial state and then their movements? Mm-hmm. And I don't see why that would naturally translate into having any understanding whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, so now our alien now is not the one making the prediction about the mass in the solar system.
Oh, right.
This,
okay.
This alien is more like us. It's just an advanced, you know, an advanced human type.
Its culture is just much, much more advanced than us. Yeah. It just has more knowledge.
This is a person, and it's a person watching Newton through a giant, incredible telescope. So that person understands calculus, and that person understands agenthood, and that person understands biology and everything relevant to us and much more. That person looking at Newton and having this vast understanding of the entire situation at the time, nothing about Newton's brain appears to be magical based on what we know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it should be, you know, in principle possible for that alien to know what the knowledge of calculus looks like at an information structural level.
Yeah, but then you already have it. That's different from predicting the future growth of knowledge, wouldn't you say?
Well, but exactly. So this is with respect to that alien. The alien cannot predict their own future knowledge because they are at the cutting edge of their own knowledge. But the alien can predict the future growth of Newton's knowledge. And so Newton does not appear to be free with respect to the alien. If the alien knows everything that's going to happen to Newton while he's sitting in that room, including every permutation of what's going to happen in his brain, the alien can predict exactly when Newton is going to realize that he's discovered calculus.
But I'm not sure. It seems like you're kind of contradicting the idea of the hard problem being insurmountable here or being the hard problem? Because this seems to just be a case of having the correspondences there or the correlations and being able to then predict.
Well, this is interesting because I don't think we need to invoke consciousness at all to explain Newton understanding calculus. Newton's understanding in calculus, like he's a pea zombie, can be explained entirely in terms of the information structure of his brain at the time. And now we know correspondences between, or at least we think we know correspondences between such and such an information structure and such and such an information process and a conscious state. So I might assume that Newton is excited. Maybe he's not excited about it. That will be a function of what happens in his brain. But in terms of the knowledge structure is itself an objective feature of the situation. It's the knowledge is the structure of Newton's brain that, you know, encodes whatever those rules are and those properties are.
But can you really separate it from his particular problem situation there? I'm not sure if it sounds kind of like in the discussion between David and Sam Harris the second time, where Sam seems to have the intuition that there's a joy receptor that we can stimulate in the brain and you would feel joy.
I think Sam's pretty off base there.
Right. But that sounds kind of similar to me that you're saying here, that we can divorce the knowledge creation from the problem situation and hence we can predict it in a more mechanical way.
I think the problem situation is also about Newton and his brain. And so again, this is an epistemological limitation of agents and themselves and their own knowledge.
But then fallibilism would be false, ultimately.
No, it is not false with respect to the alien. The alien still doesn't know its own future knowledge and cannot predict it. And Newton, knowing that some alien could in principle watch him discovering calculus, he can't learn calculus by imagining an alien and then thinking about what they might see, right? And the alien can't learn about their own future discovery by imagining a yet more powerful alien and thinking about what they might see.
No, and I would say the explanation of if Newton chooses not to learn or come up with these theories is also best explained by the concept of free will, though. Even in the framework that you're laying out, even if I concede that point, I think free will.
When you say best explained, though, so now let's imagine, you know, we're the alien and we're staring at Newton, and we have the kind of physics that lets us predict what's going to happen in his brain and in that room, right? And part of why this is a useful experiment is the idea that we can fully examine that situation within the bounds that are relevant to it. Now, one of the kind of measurement problem, right, that we run into is, you know, we can't see all of the inputs that will be happening to ourselves and to that system and so on. You need to kind of get very fine grained, and then you need to have a problem that is at a level where the kind of measurement errors you'll run into are not, you know, going to be relevant to it. So we need a very powerful alien, and they need to see a lot of the Earth and a lot of the surrounding solar system so that they know all the inputs that are going to be relevant to Newton and his brain. We can see now the possibilities there. Maybe we even have some uncertainty, and we can say, you know, given this little difference in this neuron here, Newton may or may not discover it based on, you know, these inputs. But we can imagine a channel whereby, you know, he's sitting at this place and he's got this paper and it's in such and such a condition. And we know that he's the kind of person who will be able to go through it and such and such. Nothing in principle stops us from outside looking at Newton, understanding everything about his brain and his situation, and understanding already the kind of knowledge that he's trying to discover in his problem situation, and then predicting what's going to happen to him on that basis.
Well, I guess one thing that weighs in on this is the whole idea of the multiverse and how that is, in principle, unpredictable from any one universe. So in that sense, we couldn't do that anyway.
I think that, I mean, that has more to do with, that's why it kind of depends on the scale of the problem, right? The multiverse doesn't stop me from predicting that, you know, my tea is going to be done within, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. Something radical might come from outside the solar system and destroy us and so on. But given the observations that I have here, I can see the teapot and I know within my own bounds all of the relevant situations to that teapot.
But that's because of the explanations that you have bearing on the situation, not any predictive possibility there. The prediction stems from the explanation, not the other way around.
Yep. And so if, you know, a powerful enough agent looking at a puny enough agent with fine enough detail and who already has explanations about the whole solar system and all the chemistry in his brain, that kind of agent with that kind of knowledge could make that kind of prediction. And it would be a prediction about Newton and his future knowledge. So this is the idea that you can't predict future knowledge is... Now, I have to say, like, do you think that's impossible pretty much? Like, it's you can't imagine a big enough, smart enough alien to look at a small enough...
I don't know. When you say powerful or big enough, you're just speaking in terms of computational power, speed and memory, or...
Yeah, all of the sensor, you know, and information they...
Because that sounds kind of like the inductivist mistake otherwise, that it just has more data, access to more data. But that's not what you mean.
Partially. I mean, it would have more knowledge and ability to understand what the data was telling it to. But yeah, I mean, our predictive power grows. Predictive
with knowledge.
Power grows with more knowledge, with more sensory, et cetera.
Absolutely. So, I don't see how... Once again, you're saying that we can predict, which is, once again, always bottom up for ultimate prediction. But how do we, even if we knew, I think since we don't know what creativity is and how that works in the causal framework of things, I think that, yeah, I'm not sure that it would be possible in principle to just look at someone's brain and circumstance and predict the future growth of knowledge there. I don't see... why that would necessarily follow from what you said there. It's a really interesting argument, and I'm not persuaded. I'm not stuck in either camp here, but I'm still not persuaded that that must be the case, given what you said there.
Let's just think about it more abstractly then, in terms of the fine grained detail. You know, this has to be a question about how fine grained can we look. You know, at what scale, basically. Does that sound right? Like, if we predicting what a computer will do is a matter of knowing the internal conditions of the computer, right? If we knew enough about, and I mean, this is kind of the old, you know, if you could make a computer giant and walk inside of it, you would just see different operations. And so we're just talking about how fine grained do we know what's happening and what. How large of a scale, right? If we want to make very precise measurements, you have to have a big machine that encompasses the entire place that you're trying to measure, right? So that you're not missing other information from outside of it and so on.
Yeah, but even, I mean, no computer, if we talk about, let's say, the Laplace's demon, which is similar, you're using another word there that I haven't asked you what it means, but I understand what you mean by it. The Dyson sphere, or what do you call it?
Dyson sphere is just it's a giant structure that encompasses a star to capture a lot of energy.
Oh,
it's
right.
A hypothetical science fiction type. Conceivable structure. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been pretending to know what that is the whole time, but that makes sense. Okay. But so, no, I think that the Laplace's demon kind of breaks down when you think of he or she, or maybe non-binary or fluid or whatever it's called nowadays, but it couldn't simulate the entirety of the universe because it would have to include a simulation of itself. Which would be changing. So it's impossible in principle to have complete information on that basis.
That might be right. So I'm sort of claiming that Newton is a relatively small system as a person, right? I am a physical system, and I'm here in this house, and the inputs to this house, you know, depend mainly on a bunch of local circumstances here. Somebody watching my entire solar system and making careful measurements at an incredibly advanced level. They could in principle know what's happening in this house with very fine detail. And the only question is whether or not the detail is fine enough that specific differences are relevant to the outcomes in my brain. And from what we know about the brain as a computer, the relevant differences seem to be fairly large relative to like quantum differences, right? Like the things that affect the outcome of my brain are at the level of neurons and you know, chemicals that go into neurons and go between neurons. Brains do not operate at the kind of level where small quantum fluctuations will usually make any kind of difference. They're a big, you know, large, and similarly, like my computer is even more, you know, grossly detailed. It does not have as many small working parts. And so this is just about how much information can I get about the system and how fine grained do I need to be to make certain predictions? Newton, as a system, the system is explicable at a fairly high level. And I don't think even if it was the level that would be relevant to quantum differences, that would just create, you know, a number of different outcomes that I could predict the ratios of their likelihood and so on. But so the main idea is that Newton as a system, he's limited by his own knowledge structure, but every knowledge structure can be understood in terms of a larger knowledge structure. And it feels like you're pushing on the agent as a, I mean, not magical, obviously, but the agent is something that makes it immune to outside prediction. But I don't think that's how this limitation of the growth of knowledge works. The limitation is about me being able to see outside of myself and my own knowledge structure. But yeah, I don't know if there's any other ways for me to jump at this point.
Yeah, because it also feels like we're kind of assuming that you already have the knowledge of Newton coming up with this theory to begin with. Like you already have his history, and because I'm thinking, and it might not be analogous. I'm getting tired here, but mm-hmm. if I have another system, let's say if I have a baby, a newborn baby, and yep. I have tons of more knowledge than a baby has, I'm still mm-hmm. completely incapable of predicting what knowledge is going to create. I don't know if that is. Kind of.
You can probably predict pretty well if you have, you know, you've got a little bit of an older child who has never been exposed to, say, negative numbers, and you know that they've never encountered that concept, and you decide, I'm going to sit down and teach them about negative numbers. You can kind of predict that their personal knowledge about numbers and about negative numbers is going to grow. And it's because you already know about negative numbers. The child does not. You're going to predict the growth of the knowledge in that child.
Maybe in a very general sense, but the child can always surprise me in a fundamental way. I think that is the claim.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's because we can't see brains at a fine enough detail to see every, you know, interaction that's about to happen and what it implies about all the other interactions and so on. Nothing prevents us from, in principle, seeing that level of detail. That's a limitation just of us and our technology.
Yeah, but I know it's not perfectly analogous at all. I get that. But it's, yeah, I still don't see how, I feel like we're running into the same problem as the first disagreement there, where if we have enough fine-grained detail and understanding of the brain, I will be able to predict the emergent abstractions, the abstract knowledge that it will create. I'm not sure if that is the same different intuition we have there. It seems similar to me. But Matt, I would like to maybe shift to an entirely different topic here mm-hmm. that I wanted to ask you about for the last part here. And I'm going to have you back on the podcast because this is way too fun. But meaning, the idea of meaning. And I know that you and I, a while back, we tweeted back and forth on this a little bit. And I don't remember your tweet verbatim, but it was something along the lines of, yeah, just posing that question, what is the meaning of life, essentially, I suppose? What's the meaning of everything? Why is it meaningful, for instance, to create knowledge ad infinitum? We're always going to just face a new problem, we solve it, and then rinse, lather, repeat, or whatever. Yeah, I don't know the saying. Yeah. But do you remember this particular conversation or this question that you were posing there?
Maybe a little bit, yeah. This is a similar kind of just limitation as far as I know, or yeah, at least as I think at the moment. I initially, when I was kind of, generally a rationalist, and I like to think in terms of logic and so on. And it feels like the new atheist kind of revolution made it very popular to react against the old systems of, like, you know, life is meaningful for these reasons because of transcendent values and because of religious, this or that. And it was tempting to say, well, we've just got a clockwork universe and everything is determined and nothing's meaningful and events just happen.
Yeah.
That seems like an overreaction to me. Meaning obviously exists in the sense that it is the kind of things that we instantiate, right? Meaning is a property of humans, at least to the extent that I can find something meaningful and you can find something meaningful. And that will be a property of us and our mental states and emotion. And people kind of want to ask, can I apply my sense of meaning to myself almost, right? Is there anything that finds me meaningful? Or is there anything that that the universe finds meaningful? It feels like that's kind of the intuition driving people.
Right.
I find meaning in this activity that I do with my family. That's meaningful to me. But is that activity, including me, meaningful in a broader sense? To me, this is another kind of question about what is the nature of existence, right? Whatever the nature of existence is kind of why are we here? And that why might be in terms of just what is the explanation for existence being here instead of not being here. But if you think in terms of agents, that might also raise the question of, you know, why does everything exist in terms of what meaning did something or someone have in mind when creating everything? And that just to me is just not within the scope of what we know at the time. So it's the kind of question that comes up and it just is equivalent to asking, what is the nature of the universe?
And so what would be your answer to that, man?
Got me. So individuals find meaning. I might slightly disagree with the general Kurtrack community. I don't think that the idea of growing knowledge, and I have disagreed with a few people about this on Twitter, the idea of just the growth of knowledge being intrinsically meaningful or valuable does not make sense to me in general. And this is kind of back to the same Sam Harris ethics is about consciousness or about the experiences of agents point. Growing knowledge might be good to the extent that it allows more beings to have more of a good life or an enjoyable life. But if I just imagine an accidental, stellar process somewhere, creating something that we would view as objective knowledge by accident, or just, equations or books just kind of get sandblasted onto some empty planet somewhere. And they constitute knowledge to the extent that, they encode real descriptions of reality such that if agents encountered them, they would be inclined to copy those and perpetuate them. I think Deutsch defines knowledge just as the kind of information that tends to instantiate itself once it's discovered.
Yeah.
That is kind of a property that then would cause, because of the nature of the universe, would cause other agents discovering this information to realize it was valuable, or that they would tend to realize that and tend to propagate it. But knowledge outside of agents doesn't make sense, or it doesn't not make sense, but it doesn't, the idea of it being valuable for itself, just sitting on a planet, sandblasted, and then it will soon be sandblasted. Way, right? Like I know.
But how about genetic knowledge? How about the idea that, everything up till the point of creative agents was purposeful in the sense of leading towards the creation of conscious and creative entities? Would you dispute that or?
Yeah, well, that kind of sounds like a similar claim about the nature. As far as we know, evolution is the same kind of abstraction as the laws of physics. It's a property about reality. In the same way that meaning is a property of us, right? As anything like this that does not fit into another framework is just a brute fact about existence as far as we know. So evolution is just the way the universe works, and it's a property of the universe. Meaning, the sensation, the subjective sensation of meaning is a property of us. And our experience, whatever else our experience is or where it comes from or why and so on, whatever it is, it's just a feature of the universe. And similar to the laws of physics, right? These are all just examples of the way the universe is for whatever reason. And so genetic evolution tends to grow. I don't know if you can say that it grows for a reason, right? This is the same, that sort of is a question about why is the universe this way, which is a question why, you know, what is the nature of the universe? And that's kind of the hard problem, easy problem, right? When you ask, why is the universe this way? You might be asking for an explanation in terms of some specific process, right? Someone might answer you like, why is evolution this way? And they might say, well, because of these properties, because of these properties of chemistry and biology and so on, that's why evolution works this way. But someone else who doesn't, they're not satisfied with that. They mean, why is anything like this way in the first place? Why is the universe this way? That's the hard problem, right? That's asking, what is the nature of the universe? Trying to figure out what the specific mechanisms are in terms of other structures that I understand, that's always the easy problem. Looking for a transcendent meaning is that kind of thing. It is looking for the nature of reality, which is worth asking about, but we seem to be pretty far away from that.
So do you think it is a, once again, Sam Harris's stance here, a pseudo problem to ask that question in the first place?
I'm not sure, you know, and this is another like almost circular kind of thing, you know. I certainly have the question, and I wonder this, why is everything here? What is the nature of the universe, basically? I do wonder it. I think that Buddhists, right, would say that's a pseudo problem. It's not a real problem. You can't ask what is the nature of everything because you're just, you know, everything just is, and it is this way. You as a system just happen to exist.
That's a cop-out, right? That seems unsatisfying to me.
Yeah, I do find it unsatisfying. I don't know, though. I can't conceive of how I would answer that question or what an answer would look like. In that way, it's kind of like consciousness. Any answer that I got that purported to be an answer would seem to be inexplicable, right? Because it would have to describe everything in terms that I already understand and would have to refer to things like, I don't know, like agents or like physics. I mean, what would be a description of the universe exists for this reason? So in terms of why, now that kind of leads to a nihilism question of like, given that we don't know any of these things and, you know, none of them are explicable at that high level, should we do anything? And this is kind of an emotionally unsatisfying answer to me a little bit, but it does seem like something's going on here, right? Like this planet looks more interesting than Mars. The evolution game, the knowledge growing game, the question of why does this knowledge keep growing and why does it behave this way and why does it have this power and so on? Asking why at a fundamental level, like there's no terms in which it's clear that we can answer that at this point. But there's nothing else going on, right? No. We're at a strange juncture in the universe. We're doing things that appear unprecedented. Somehow, you know, everything looks totally empty. I am kind of a fan of the Fermi problem. Why don't we see aliens? That's an interesting problem.
Yeah.
And Deutsch talks about that too. And it feels like just another unresolved question at the moment, but it seems obvious. And again, not in a way that can be explained fundamentally. It's just, this is a brute fact. It's like red. It's like your experience. The idea that what we're doing as a human species here is unique and interesting and different. It appears not to be at the level of the laws of physics that we know, right? It appears to just be more of that. But why does this work this way? It seems interesting. And because we keep growing knowledge, it seems like there's nothing else to do but continue. Like if you want to, if you personally, you know, want to stop, that's fine. You're free to. But in terms of, you know, what should we do at the ethical level question, it seems like we should keep the game going because there's no other game in town, right?
Are you sympathetic to the idea that it is inherently meaningful, meaning being an emergent phenomenon, of course, and that, yeah, the whole idea about how joy, feeling joy, mm-hmm. is a matter of actively creating knowledge, and it doesn't get old for us. It seems like being joyous today is just as fun and exciting as being joyous when you were 10 or 5 or 15 or when you're going to be 50. It's not like the hedonistic pleasures of just, yeah, getting a dopamine hit, or it seems to be something more to it than that. But is that maybe just parochial to the kind of creatures we are, or do you think there's something more to it than that, the universe kind of being this knowledge creating entity as a whole, in a way?
Yeah, I mean, if I picture something like that, and this is, it's the same kind of, you know, we can't predict what future will look like. I do like to imagine, you know, if people discovered the complete laws of physics, it turns out that fallibilism is kind of wrong. There's a final answer here and we've got it and we can predict everything. And we don't see any problems. There doesn't seem to be any direction to go to learn new physics. We can see exactly what we can predict. And we have a map of all the possibilities that we can bring about. What do we do then? You know, make that as fantastic as you want. We can reconstruct the solar system and we can blast ourselves to new solar systems. And we've determined that we can, you know, people the universe with people like us. But, you know, there's nothing suggesting that there's any problems left or any questions to solve. We're just here hanging out in all the same ways we already know. That is itself a weird kind of existential question, right? Like, well, what do you do then? Does everyone just hang out? You just hang out forever? And
I was going to say, yeah, I discussed this with Sam Kuipers in the last episode and the whole idea, because I mentioned to a colleague of mine who's not philosophically interested at all in general. And I tried to explain fallibilism and how we could never reach any final answers. And he felt like that was kind of depressing and he couldn't grasp why it wouldn't just be better ultimately.
Yeah, I don't see that either, to be honest. I don't see the advantage. I don't see why it would be better to always have problems or to always be except that's just a brute fact about us. If it's just a fact that like, well, you're only going to enjoy yourself if you're solving problems. Well,
yes. Like, yeah, exactly. It's dependent on that. I would agree with that. And it's, I mean, to just watch TV or to just everything we do that we enjoy is in this framework. Yeah, it's a byproduct of effectively creating knowledge. Even watching a good movie is because you're actually creating a lot of knowledge, solving problems about the plot and trying to understand everything.
They're wrong. I'm not super convinced about those things. I mean, they...
Oh, really?
They make some intuitive sense, but it's not clear, let's say. And there's I don't see a good... And that's the kind of thing that can only be gestured at, right?
I love that you don't buy into all of these things right away. Yeah. This is great. But so do you have an alternative explanation that is better that is keeping you from that or
no?
Why the hesitation?
I just don't see a full explanation of why that would be the case. And it feels like there's trivial counterexamples, right? If I'm just laying in the sun and enjoying, I'm just, you know, not thinking, meditating, lying on the beach with the sun in my face, Deutsch might say like, well, your subconscious is free to work then and you're creating subconscious knowledge and that's why it feels good.
Or even that you're working, you're creatively learning how to interact with that sensational profile of having the sun in your face and the certain temperature. And
yeah, I mean, you can, there's definitely plausible stories and all of them, they do seem plausible and they're certainly, you know, I certainly consider them, but I don't see a real explanation about why I might not just enjoy it for other reasons. You know, maybe just because of the kind of monkey that I am, you know, I have been programmed to enjoy the sun in my face and I have been programmed to enjoy, you know, a relief of worrying about whatever the things I'm, that doesn't seem just de facto impossible. And so while that's a plausible explanation, like I don't, and when you go on Twitter and you see someone like Nick Camerata, I don't know if you've seen him, he's an AI researcher at OpenAI.
Oh, I have. Yeah. Oh, he talks about MDMA and self-love and that stuff, right?
Yeah. I mean, people like him and people who, you know, they appear to be walking the walk. And again, it's impossible for me to verify any of this because I can't get in his head. For all I know, he's just delusional and lying, but he's very happy. And he'll claim that, you know, you can just hack your brain and get it into this state. And that seems no less plausible to me than the Deutsch story that it's creation of knowledge. Those both seem like just possibilities pending more neuroscience, basically.
But I think you could explain what he is doing in the Deutschian framework, because I actually happen to be extremely interested in the same things Nick are interested in, and I would say that I walk the walk, maybe not to the extent that he is. I haven't talked to him. I don't know how giddy he is as a person, but this is very interesting to think about.
Okay, I want to point out just a little suspicion there, though.
Yeah.
When if you say, I can explain this in the Deutschian framework, right? When you can explain everything in the framework and there's always a ready, it's a little reason to be suspicious because I do feel the same way, right? Like I can, and especially in this kind of area where we do not have specific explanations.
Yeah.
It can't be compelling to just say, I can tell a story in my framework about why that should be the way it is. Because sure, I can do that with anything. And then, you know. Have I learned? I can always explain it.
Absolutely. That's a great point. And I haven't in a long time felt intellectual vertigo a little bit and feeling like I'm not as solid ground as I thought. And it's one of my favorite feelings. I got it when I started interrogating these ideas. And I'm very happy that you made me feel that. So this has been really great. I know that my recording software, my new one, is going to stop us here at 2 hour mark. So I would love to have you back sometime. And we didn't even get to the Twitter questions, which I know that people will be bummed about. So
I can look forward to that.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to coerce you back sometime. Thanks a lot, Matt. This was great.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you got it.